It's been our privilege to know Brother Norby for a good many years, and we've appreciated his faithfulness in serving the Lord and the steadfastness in the truth. And so I'm sure that we're in for a blessing here today. Brother Norby asked me not to announce his subject because he didn't want you all to walk out before he got started. So we're giving him that option now of announcing his own subject and explaining it to you. Brother Norby, please.
Well, very happy to be here. And, of course, I bring you the Christian love and greetings of our home class, Patterson, New Jersey, and especially of my wife. You can be sure that she is following the program at this convention, and be sure that she's here in spirit. Well, our topic, the overkill. You see what I mean? I can't help it that we're living in an age of the overkill. But I think we should try to do something about getting into that mood or into that position ourselves. Now, of course, when we speak of the overkill, we were starting with the secular and national affairs. We have reference to the nuclear bombs. And both Russia and the United States, to leave the other nations out, either one of them have enough atomic bombs to destroy the other one several times over. Now, how many, I don't know. But, nobody knows. But it's terrific. In fact, if they both would release the atomic bombs and any atomic war, it would probably not only annihilate the human species, but might destroy all life on the earth. Now, they call that the overkill. When they have more than enough bombs to destroy their enemies, they call they begin to reckon in the overkill. Now, we have another instance of overkill, I think, in Vietnam. That nation, both North and South, has been devastated. Both North and South Vietnam. Why, they have bomb craters there that we probably never will be able to fill up. And actually, while it might appear as though the war is being scaled down over there with the bombing that is now going on in North Vietnam, no matter when and how they sign a peace agreement, North Vietnam is going to be destroyed for decades to come. They're destroyed, whether they surrender or not. Well, that's the awesome spectacle that we have there. And actually, this is the battleground, really, between the East and the West. And it falls upon that little segment of geography over there. And it's certainly another instance of overkill. Now, I think in this election, we're going to probably see another overkill. If the polls are not completely wrong, this will be one of the most one-sided elections that's ever been held in this country. And they're not sparing the horses, even now. I wonder if they realize the danger that's involved in this situation. Remember that the young people were encouraged to get into the establishment and participate in the primaries for the Democratic nomination, which they did. Quite many of them. So many of them, in fact, that they elected their candidates. But it's one thing to elect the candidate over the conservative elements in the Democratic Party. It's something else to elect that candidate to the presidency over the conservatives in the Democratic Party and the whole Republican Party, practically. So we really have an overkill in this election. And here, I think, is where danger may lie. We don't want to get into the political aspect of these things. You know, we know that we'll cooperate with whatever party is in power. We'll live within the law, as long as it doesn't contradict the law of God. But we have to mention these things, and it really does lead up to our own position in this whole situation. Now, these young people, particularly, have been encouraged to get into the establishment and work within the establishment. Now, if their candidate suffers the most ignominious defeat in history of this nation and almost any nation, can you imagine the frustration? And can you expect them to try again to work within the establishment by the power of the ballot? And if you can't, you know what the alternative to ballots is. It's bullets or violence, you see. But now, since almost certainty that Nixon will be elected, we'll probably see the situation quieted down to a certain extent by compulsion. And the pastor has expressed it very well, that they will sit on the safety valve. Of course, you know, even the sisters know what happens in the pressure cooker if the safety valve isn't working and you don't turn off the heat. And they're not turning off the heat. And the pastor says that this would lead to an explosion. Now, that's what it seems that we're heading into right now. Now, we have another odd situation, really. We have these special efforts to get a peace now in Southeast Asia. And I wonder if we realize what terrific forces are at work in this situation and what tremendous leverage there is against the North Vietnamese to negotiate at this time. They're reading the polls. They know they're going to have to deal with Nixon after he's elected. Well, he'll have nothing to lose because he can't be reelected again anyway. And we can be sure that Henry Kissinger is pointing out that now we need you now to ensure a victory in a political campaign. So it's to our interest. If we negotiate a peace now, we give you a very good deal. But if we're elected anyway, which is evidence that they would be, of course you can't expect to get such a good deal. Well, you see, there's an implied threat there. So North Vietnamese are under tremendous pressure now to make a deal. However, there's another element to deal with, and that's South Vietnam. President Thieu is reading the polls too. And he knows that McGovern practically hasn't got a ghost of a chance of being elected, you see. And he can certainly be assured that Nixon will give him a better deal than McGovern would anyway when he's reelected. So why should South Vietnam agree to a peace? So there is a stalemate, you see, the terrific pressure that's involved in this. And this overkill situation in the election. Now, coming down to our own problems, maybe we could be involved in an overkill, too, particularly with regard to Babylon and the old world order that's out of harmony with the new arrangement. You know, Paul expressed it very well. He said, everything that can be shaken will be shaken, but that which cannot be shaken may remain. See, he wasn't against everything, but everything that isn't on the firm foundation of justice and righteousness will be shaken. Now, isn't that good riddance? See? But it can involve a terrific turnover. And the point is that this is well underway. The forces are at work that's going to accomplish this. The Lord's great army is at work. And we don't have to get involved to accomplish the overthrow of the world order. that is being done by other forces. We have a specific job to do. And I'm afraid that if we don't recognize what has been happening and the progress that has been made in that direction, we could become involved in an overkill. In other words, we feel that we've got to plague Babylon, if we've got to bring about the overthrow of the present order of things, we're getting into something that we're not supposed to be involved in the first place, and it's something that's entirely unnecessary. These forces are already at work, and if we get involved in that, then we are guilty of an overkill too. And it, the worst of it is, not that we could make much difference anyway, but if it keeps us from doing our job, well, then that could be serious in its consequences. As we know that we're not supposed to be involved in the physical aspects of this battle. It isn't necessary, as I think we can demonstrate. Now, one mistake I think we make is that the mother system has come to great power. And that, of course, is contrary to the pastor's teaching. He showed that their power ended forever in 1799. Their actual power. Except for a very slight period, recorded, I think, in Revelation 17. But otherwise, the persecuting power had been broken. And one of the reasons that it had been broken over the Lord's people is the fact that the Lord's people have escaped Europe, which was the bastion of that strength. It was the mother system that ruled Europe in conjunction with the kings of Europe. And ruling Europe, they ruled the world. But where are the most of the Lord's people? Are over here. So they're not under the influence to start with. There's a lot of Bible students in Poland, but they're not under the direct power of that system either, because that is a communist, and the communists are more or less like a referee over there between the various religious systems, you see. So they get a lot of liberty over there, over behind the Iron Curtain. And there aren't too many in Europe itself. Now, someone might say, well, that's overemphasizing the United States, where most of the Bible students are, where the harvest work started and where it's conducted mainly, and it fed back into Europe through the language groups, you see. But this is what the pastor taught. I have, you know, I have a lot of notes on this that I can't take time to read. I know sometimes people are afraid of papers. Well, I don't blame them. All the papers that come to us, we know that they're hardly worth reading. But why aren't they worth reading? Because the brethren that send them around wouldn't be invited to speak to us. Am I right? And that's why their papers are not helpful. But anyone that speaks in line with the truth, if they extend their notes, those notes should be in harmony with their general understanding. And so it can save a lot of time. I'll make some of these notes available, so I wouldn't have time to cover them in detail. And the subject, of course, is rather involved. But on this sheet, it shows many references where that persecuting power ended forever in 1799, as such. Oh, but look out from another direction. Revelation 13 clearly shows that it's the image of the beast. That is the final power. The original ten-horned beast is still on the scene. The two-horned beast, representing England, is there. But it's the image of the beast that has the power. Now, this represents a power or a nation that's independent of Europe, independent of England, and has taken over the power, particularly of England, two-horned beast. And, of course, you see where that lands us. It lands us over in this area. Now, to show that while persecution and suppression of the truth may come, not through the churches, through civil power, the church is working with the civil. The church has never had any power. It's a misnomer to say that the churches are going to have power. The church has never had power in itself. It's only as it's worked through the princes and kings and secular authorities. See. And so it'll be secular power working in conjunction with the weakened churches that can give us a lot of trouble. Now, I want to call attention to one paragraph in the third volume where the pastor, in one short paragraph, uses seven expressions indicating that the churches will be going down at the time that they lash out and perhaps suppress the truth. Now, notice that. I'll count them off as I read a short paragraph, page 231 in the third volume, paragraph 2. It will probably, in an effort at self-preservation, one, defensive, self-preservation, on the part of Great Babylon, Christendom, that is the whole, you know, that's a family name, Babylon, mother and daughters, when she sees her power in politics and priestcraft and superstition waning, number two, waning, power waning, that the work of truth spreading will be stopped as detrimental, three. How do they know it's detrimental? They've felt the effects of it. As detrimental to her system. And probably at this juncture, the Elijah class persisting in declaring the truth to the last. Not as a result of an entirely different message to stir them up. Notice that? Persisting in declaring the truth. What they've been doing all along. Will suffer violence, pass into glory, and escape from the severe features of the great time of trouble coming, just in the crisis of affairs, number four. Crisis, life or death, right? When men begin to feel that desperate, number five, measures must be resorted to sustain, not to build up higher, but to sustain what they still have. The tottering, what do you think of that? The tottering structure of Christendom. At page 231 in the third volume, I think that makes sense, too. And I think we see that situation today. Now, this thought that we have a great work of plaguing Babylon and starting all of this trouble, which they're all actually already in, see. We can't start anything. It's already going, well underway, see. But those thoughts are gleaned mainly from the symbolisms of the book of Revelation. Certain parts of Revelation are considered have not been fulfilled, and we have to fulfill them. And that leads, I think, is probably the major argument in favor of some great smiting work that has to be done by the Lord's people against the present system of error. Well, the pastor, you know, said over and over again, we were not supposed to base a doctrine on a type. And, of course, we shouldn't base a doctrine on a symbol either, then, should we? And the book of Revelation is a book of symbols. See how easily we could misinterpret those symbols and start preaching a doctrine or a practice or a policy based upon our understanding of those symbols. And we're not all agreed as to what those symbols represent. As a matter of fact, I think you have two extreme views on the subject. Some think that practically everything is in the past, and some think that practically everything is in the future. Personally, it seems to me we're right in the middle. There things have happened, and there's some things that remain to happen, I think. And I'm tackling this subject partly because I think I have a moderate view of a basis on which we may be able to reconcile some of these differences. But there's another overriding reason why I'm concerned about this overkill if we get involved in it. You know, I'm on the Cole Porter Committee now. It was a new committee that was organized at the Fort Collins Convention. And they say, oh, there he is, Brother Norby, he's excited about that because he's on the committee. Well, actually, I wouldn't have accepted the appointment to the committee if I didn't believe in the Cole Porter work. But now that I'm on it, why, I'm all the more concerned. In fact, it becomes an obligation to carry this work forward, which I think is the work that we should be engaged in, directly or indirectly, to get the truth literature out in its original form. And so I don't want to see the energy of the Lord's people, the attention of the Lord's people, and the finances of the Lord's people siphoned off into this overkill of what we've been speaking about. And that's why I'm really quite concerned about it. And I think we continue to show how that this is in harmony with the pastor's advice, too. We've indicated that Revelation 13 indicates the image of the beast would be in the final picture, the final power. The pastor, in fact, in one place in the second volume, he says that he wouldn't be surprised if in this nation that someday would have a king or a monarch, become a monarchy. Well, they don't call them kings anymore, you see. But they can become dictators. See, that's the modern name for that autocratic power. One commentator, Pritchie, I've followed him occasionally, and he seems to size up the situation past and present and future as any of the columns. And he points out that the first 2 years of Nixon administration was the true Nixon. There he overhauled the Supreme Court. He threw out a lot of liberal legislation by edict, suppressed unrest on the campuses, quelled prison riots, even in New York, you know, about 40 men died in that. But it quiets things down for a while. That policy works, of course, works for a while, just like sitting on the safety valve quiets things down, even though it leads up to a blown boiler, you see. And his theory is that the last 2 years, Brother Nixon has been working to get elected. And he documents this, too. Now, I've got some copies of his column, if you're interested in his documentation of those facts. He shows that he's working to get elected. The one he's elected, and then he won't have anything to lose. He doesn't have to, he can't look for another term anyway. We could expect, and he points this out, that you could expect the true Nixon to show up. And this could lead to the very suppression we're talking about here, suppression of the truth. We may not have too much time to use the mails freely and to have public meetings and to circulate the truth, just the ordinary truth. Now, of course, if the election goes the other way, if the liberals get in, this, I think, would postpone things for a while. But let's release the pressure on this boiler, you see. But eventually, the pastor shows that this is what we'd expect. We'd expect a repression. Now, Revelation 17, that is considered to be future. You see, if there are a lot of things that have to be fulfilled, it would automatically push things way ahead. In addition to the fact that it would siphon off our energies and attention to accomplish those things, which are an overkill. Revelation 17, I have notes on this Revelation 17. I have a suggestion on that. I think the hour of Revelation 17 is past. The only hint that the pastor gives us on this is in the comment on the seventh head. He says the seventh head was the House of Savoy. In other words, Victor Emmanuel. And it's a striking fact that Mussolini became the head of the Italian government, working with Hitler, and he was acknowledged head of the Italian government. Everybody recognized that. He eclipsed King Victor Emmanuel. But Mussolini was never anything more than the prime minister of King Victor Emmanuel. Now, I don't think you could find a better fit for this expression. He is the eighth, but it's of the seventh, than the fact that Mussolini was prime minister under Victor Emmanuel, and he, together with Hitler, dominated Europe. Another striking point, for 3 years and 4 months, which is 1/12 of a 40-year judgment cycle, or a 1/24 of an 80-year judgment cycle. See? Exactly 3 years and 4 months. They dominated Europe. And in one, I think 1954 could well be a very important date. Historians oftentimes begin stressing certain dates long after the have passed, like 1914, for instance. Now, 1954 could well be a very important date because the Colombo powers called a meeting of all Asia African nations. This was in November 1954. They called this meeting for the spring of 1955. They deliberately excluded their erstwhile rulers, the Western nations. They could only sit in as observers. And the topic was colonialism. And they were divided. There was pro-Western and pro-communist nations involved. And one got up and denounced Western colonialism, the other got up and denounced the communist colonialism, pointing to Poland, Latvia, Estonia, and the states under communism. But the one thing they agreed on, that colonialism was dead. Colonialism had to go. They repudiated it. They declared their independence of their erstwhile rulers. Now, I submit that could be a very significant point. You know, the American people celebrate the Declaration of Independence. Actually, that declaration wouldn't have meant anything if they hadn't won the war. How many Americans know when the war ended that made that Declaration of Independence valid? And so when these nations repudiated their erstwhile rulers, and if they make it stick, the historians may go back to that date and say, here is where colonialism ended. And I think colonialism, in a general way, represents the image of Daniel. World dominion, see. And without colonialism, you can't dominate the world. Europe, prior to 1914, dominated the world. Now, what's happened to that those dominions? Their colonies have been lost. We know that's the passing phase in this transition period. These nations are freed so that they can line up with the new order, and you know what that is. The fifth universal empire, the kingdom of God. It's a rough period, but it's necessary, transition. And of course, as I say, these things have been largely accomplished. Europe, you see, dominated by the mother system, is definitely on the wane. And the power has been taken over mainly by Protestant countries. And that's is the image of the beast, you see. The pastor used Herod, Herodias, and Salome as a type of a church-state situation down at the end of the age. Now, in that picture, it was Salome that had the power, not Herodias. In fact, Herodias had practically been rejected. When Herod offered to give Salome anything up to half of the kingdom, you realize the implication of that? Well, that was tantamount to a proposal of marriage. If a woman had half of the kingdom, she would really be a queen, wouldn't she? Now, it's certain that Herod wasn't going to give Salome his half of the kingdom. No, it was what Herodias thought she once had and wanted to hold on to, you see. But she was powerless, that's the point. But the mother had the ideas. Now, that's where she fits into the picture. But it's Protestantism that really is the power, final power. So we're not doing the cause any good by insisting that the mother system is going to be raised to great power. In the first place, it isn't the mother. In the second place, the church is... never have a power. It's civil power that happens to be allied with them, is it? So we ought to keep our terminology as great as possible, and it will avoid some of the conflicts that we might have on the subject. I have a sheet on Revelation 17, if anybody interested in these suggestions. So when the pastor mentioned that this might become a monarchy, he's talking about this country. He wasn't talking about Europe. They already had their kings. The time he spoke, right? Now, this is the country that's going to affect us. This is the country that has the power. There was another interesting thing that might point up the importance of 1954. You know when the United States moved into Vietnam? When France moved out. 1954. That ties in with what we've already suggested. The United States attempted to take over the power which was lost by Europe. And I think that the image of the beast became very active at that point. In fact, we've lost a lot of that power. Back there in the early 60s, the United States had a force of over 3 million men stationed around the world, policing the world. It's what the two horned beasts used to do, you see. But now it's the image of the beast that's taken over this power. Not only religious, you see, but a beast is a religious government. It isn't just a church system. It's also secular power. All right? That's what constitutes a beast. Now, we have that combination. Protestant power, backed up by a terrific military and economic power, which has been practically ruling the world or policing the world. Now, they're on the wane. The forces are being reduced, and they no longer can buy the little nations. And actually, we may be over the hump, but that's when the danger comes in. You folks that have hunted big game, you know that the animal is the most dangerous after they've been wounded. And so, Babylon, mortally wounded, is desperate and dangerous. And the same would be true if the secular power realizes they're beginning to lose their power. See? That, I think, is a dangerous situation. Now, this thought of, if you think I'm overemphasizing the importance of the United States as far as the Lord's people are concerned, I wish you would turn to the fourth volume, page 588, where the signs that the Lord said would mark his coming before he actually arrived. They remember the dark day in 1780 and the falling stars in 1833. Those signs were not visible in Europe at all. Those signs were visible in this country, and Brother Russell points that out. And so the truth movement has to start over here. Now, if we're still trying to kill Europe, you see, we're engaged in this overkill. And if we feel we've got to destroy the systems as such, in this country even, we're engaged in overkill also, I think. Now, one point that I believe that has been overlooked in general by Bible students, this is a very important point. We know it's the truth that is the power. But it is not exclusively the truth that we have on religious lines. The pastor shows over and over again that it's truth along every line, not on a religious truth. Scientific truth, social truth, political truth. And isn't it that truth that is weakening the present order? Of course, a great deal of stress. I'll just give these references quickly. Second volume, page 101, the bottom of the page. That's volume 2, 101. 147, paragraph 2, the second volume. Same second volume, 358, paragraph 3. And 360, paragraph 4. That's just in one volume. You'll find it, I think, in practically all the volumes, that matter. Truth along every line. As having its part in the Lord is using truth along every line to tear down the systems of error in order that the kingdom of God can be established. Now, great expectations with regard to Jordan, the smiting of Jordan, and the pastor did mention that. He expected that there was a significance in that as a type. And he said that we had reached Jordan in 1914. Well, I still believe that. But what is difficult for me to accept is that we've been standing at the River Jordan doing nothing for 57 years. I find it difficult to believe that in the first place, that we would be standing still that long. Lord's people don't stand still, really. Moreover, there's evidence that the River Jordan is representing the peoples of the world is being divided, and is pretty well divided now. You know, literally, when the River Jordan was divided, the waters went north and south. I don't see any special significance in that, north and south. If it is east and west, maybe we could attach something to it in view of the world situation. But the waters were divided north and south, so I think we should forget about the directions. But it is true that when you divide a river, no matter which direction it flows, that you're dividing it right and left. And isn't there evidence that the world is being divided right and left? Liberal and radical on the one side, conservative and reactionary on the other. In fact, you know, it's hard to find anybody that's neutral anymore. And the pastor went so far as to say that maybe the Lord's people are the only ones that would be able to maintain the neutrality and would not be cooperating with the selfishness on either one side or the other. So actually, you know, Elijah, he apparently walked through on dry ground. And if we are neutral, as we should be, see the rights and wrongs on both sides, we're practically alone. There's no water there. I suggest you make a survey of people and find out. Very definite ideas. Either one side or the other, right or left. And it's truth along every line that's done that. It isn't just religious truth. You see the point? So I think that that the River Jordan is pretty well divided right now. And if we feel we've got to do that, then we are engaging again in overkill, as I said, on this issue. Now, Jeremiah 1:10 shows that Jeremiah was set for the destruction of all the nations. Now, he was not a warrior. He didn't lift the sword. But he pronounced the judgments, didn't he? That were carried out, in that case, by Nebuchadnezzar. And all the nations did become subject to Nebuchadnezzar, just as Jeremiah prophesied. And so, this message has been given. Been given all down through the Brotherhood ministry. He's told what was going to happen. And it has been happening. Now, Revelation 14, about the harvest of the earth, has been used as an indication of some great work in the future. Because in verse 17, it says that another angel said to gather the clusters of the vine of the earth. Now, the fact that it's mentioned afterward leads some to think that this starts after all the church is gathered. See? But it isn't necessarily so. If it was the same angel, there might be a little weight to that idea, but it was another angel that carried on this work. So they could be going on simultaneously, couldn't they? And I think they have been. You know, the it talks about the reaper in one prophecy. It says the plowman shall overtake the reaper. They're both traveling at the same time. The plowman, the time of trouble starts after the reaper, you see, made considerable progress. But the time of trouble is catching up with the reaping work. And when it catches up, that'll be the end. Well, that fits in what the pastor said, too. The time of trouble will stop the harvest work, and that will close the door. You see why I'm so anxious if we try to find those last members that have to be gathered before the plowman catches up to us. It's another angel, you see, that does that. Now, further corroboration of this is the fact that in the parable of the wheat and the tares, which is very similar, you see, the wheat would be the harvesting of the earth. The tares would correspond to the vine of the earth, right? And specifically in that parable, he says, gather first the tares, bind them in bundles, burn them. Not and burn them. Gather them. And, you know, out on the farm, you know what you do. You cut them off and let them dry a while. See? There's no hurry to burn them. And they burn better anyway after they've dried out a while. And that's what I think that scripture shows. And so the harvesting of the vine of the earth does not necessarily begin after the harvest of the earth of the wheat is completed. See the point? So we don't. That's no indication that we've got this terrific work to do. So far as the judging of the world is concerned. No, we are harvesters. We're not plowmen. And our main job is not to burn the tares either. They're being burned by a lot of other elements that are working on that. Now, this the matter of the second presence. You know, the divine plan of the ages does not show that we are to get all the great company class out of Babylon. The chart is in harmony with the pastor's teaching. That Babylon falls away from the great company class. Is that right? The great company are here all the time, you see? And they don't fall when Babylon falls. Babylon falls away from the great company. It shows a little flock leaving Babylon, very clearly. But it doesn't show the great company leaving Babylon. It doesn't show the little flock getting the great company out of Babylon by any amount of work we might do. The great company will leave Babylon when Babylon falls away from them. Now, that's what the chart shows. That's what my pastor's writings show, too. But we don't have a great work, even, to get rescue the great company from Babylon. The message of the second presence is for the virgin class. It's not for the world in general. That is shown clearly in the third volume. I'd like to, just to illustrate the points that I've made so far, I'd like to tell some stories and use some illustrations. I think some of you have heard them. But I still think they are apropos. To tell the churches that nothing has happened to them, that they've not been plagued yet, that we're just waiting until we get at you, you know, would be like the story of the manager who was encouraging his fighter in the ring who wasn't doing very well. And he says, get in there and fight. He says, he hasn't played a glove on you. Well, the fighter, he shook his head and blinked his eyes. He says, would you do me a favor? In the next round, watch the referee. Somebody in there has given me an awful beating. And I think that that's the reaction you'd get from the churches if we try to tell them that nothing has happened to them yet. You haven't been plagued. Again, the meteorologist. The old-timer was turning the office over to the young fellow out of college, and he brought in all his instruments, and the old fellow, rather skeptical, and he says, hey, he said, would you do me one favor? He said, you figure it all out on the machine, but before you issue the forecast, will you look out the window, please? And I think we should watch as well as pray and study. And I think if we look out the window, we'll see the things happening that I've been mentioning here, and actually what the pastor predicted. Again, I think to be over-concerned about this, take ourselves too seriously, it would be like a quarterback, a football team, who thinks his job is to knock down all those big linemen and tackles and guards on the opposite side of the team. He don't have to do that. Because there are other fellows on his team that are knocking down the big fellows in the opposition. And that's what's happening right now. But you see, the play was called. In fact, I think the pastor called the play, and it's been running ever since. And the large great army is doing its job. But we don't have to do all of that. If we do, we'd be engaged in this overkill that I think we should avoid. They're being smeared by these others, but we don't need to do it. And if we just look around, we'll see that they're down. We don't have to put them down anymore. They're out of the play anyway. They're out of the play. Now, another illustration I think would be where we could avoid getting into unnecessary trouble. And that is, you've heard the expression, we're supposed to hew to the line, let the chips fall where they may. Our job is to hew to the line. See? But now if we get over anxious and we get involved in this overkill, why, we might cut out a nice big chip, you see, and put our axe down and just wail off and hit this guy in the back of the neck. If he looks around and he sees us smiling, you know, as though we're having a good time, you're in trouble, see, more than you ought to be. But if he looks around, he gets hit with a chip, and he looks around, he sees you chopping away, and you have a purpose in mind, well, he's going to feel a little different about it. He still isn't going to like it, but he isn't going to take it out on you justifiably. See the point? I think this involves this. Now, someone might say, well, if you put out the first volume, that is so bland that is not going to get any message across at all. Well, as a matter of fact, there's plenty in the first volume as a starter. The judgment on the papacy, you'll find it on page 259, paragraph 2, 260, paragraph 1. Now imagine if you were in their position and you read that. That would be pretty strong. That in itself. Now, as far as the Protestants are concerned, they don't escape either. Page 270, paragraph 2, 333, top of the page. If you were in one of those denominations and you read that, you would feel that that's pretty strong medicine. In the first volume. Let's put out this first volume. That's where you start. That's the logical place to start. And that contains the whole message of truth. Now, of course, I think that the brethren who are the most vulnerable to this overkill are the younger brethren. They're full of zip and vitality, you know. And they're the ones the most vulnerable to it. And it seems to me, I can detect that the younger brethren get themselves together. They're little pockets of young brethren that get all enthused about some particular work. But you know, all of the Lord's work isn't to be done in one locality anyway. And as a member of the Cole-Porter Committee, I'm going to urge the younger brethren to scatter around, distribute themselves in the classes, mingle with the older brethren. The older brethren need them. And believe me, they need the older brethren, too. If we're going to have to do a harvest work, we're not going to do it in just two or three places in the country. It's going to be all over. Okay? And we should spread ourselves as much as possible. I like this idea of using a mailing list. That gets away from this manpower problem. And let's use that while we can still use the mails. That's the point. I also have a paper on John the Baptist type. And you know, the pastor stresses the fact that we should get very busy in the harvest work, because the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine at all. Sound doctrine. When they will not tolerate the message that he was publishing in 1904, for instance. That wasn't any special message, was it? That is just the plain truth. And he said they'd stop that. As I say, I have on that. Now, of course, another distraction is that if the truth itself is undermined. Now, you know, you have to have the truth in order to proclaim the truth, don't you? And we cannot let go unnoticed the efforts at undermining the truth. Now, if you brethren are not aware of these changes, I have a chart of the ages, outline of the chart of the ages in black, superimposed in red, the errors that are being promulgated, which undermines the truth. There'd be 13 points on the chart of the ages that would be changed by these errors. Tabernacle shadows is riddled. Now, we can't overlook that either, can we? We're interested in putting out the truth. We've got to have the truth, and we should have it in its purity. A lot of people are putting out a lot of truth. But to put out 90% truth doesn't get a very high mark in the Lord. We don't get 90% for putting out 90% truth. Well, we'd flunk in that test if we didn't have a better percentage of truth than that. So let's be sure we have a message to witness to. We've got to, in order to witness the truth, we've got to have the truth. Another thing we should avoid, putting organizations ahead of the truth. Organizations are useful. I would be inclined to say they're almost necessary, some kind of cooperation. But if we put the organization ahead of the truth, we're getting the cart before the horse. You know, doctrines are represented by horses. And chariots, or carts, represent organizations. Now, let's let the doctrine pull the organization. Then we're keeping the horse ahead of the cart. And if we follow an organization into error, well, then we're putting the cart before the horse, to use a common expression. The matter of causing divisions. Let me give you some scriptures on who are causing divisions. The wrong people are blamed, you know. The devil puts light for darkness and darkness for light. Who are causing the divisions among the Lord's people today? 1 Corinthians 1:10. Romans 16:17. 2 Timothy 3:14. Colossians 2, 6, and 7. And 2 Thessalonians 2:15. You know, there was a confrontation between Ahab and Elijah. When Elijah returned, you know, after he had prayed for a drought because of the wickedness of the nation, you know, and Ahab cites him, "Ah, you that troubleth Israel." Well, he didn't get away with that. Elijah pointed out the sins of Ahab that had brought about that whole situation. So let's not be confused by that. Well, we trust that we have stirred up the subject anyway, and you may want to study it some more. As I say, if you wish to have some of these notes, we have extra copies of them, many of them.
Thanks, Brother Norby. I thought for a while we were going to have a real overkill on time there. Brother Wilmot has asked us to announce that the eating arrangements have been changed, and we will now be served instead of having the regular buffet style arrangement. Room number one here, which you're facing, is set up with tables. And if you will go into that room and be seated, you will be served your meal at the table. Now, this applies not only tonight, but also tomorrow noon for our noon meal. Let's close this meeting with the use of the last verse of 47. The last verse of 47 will arise as we sing that verse. And then we would ask Brother Norby to invoke the Lord's blessing upon the evening meal also.
Our kind, loving Father in heaven, we thank Thee for Thy great love toward us